This time on your weekly constitutional.
My argument is, and what I think my disquiet with people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, notwithstanding the fact I admire them both greatly, is I think they are refusing in their policies to recognize the distrust of the federal government, which has enabled, for example, supply-side tax cutters to go further and further with tax cuts in a way that, notwithstanding the lack of empirical evidence, it's gone unrebutted by Democratic administrations when they do take office.
That was Akram Pfizer, my friend and colleague at the Duncan School of Law, talking about a new law review article he's written in which he outlines seven ways in which we can reduce income inequality and restore trust in government. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Akram Pfizer is a friend of mine and a colleague at the Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. In fact, our offices are practically next door to each other. So we have lots of opportunities to talk about important issues in constitutional law. And recently, Akram mentioned to me that he'd written a law review article with a very contemporary theme that outlines seven ways in which to reduce income and wealth inequality and perhaps restore some of the trust that seems to be lacking in government these days. So, Akram Pfizer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
That is sort of my dream introduction, Akram, but sadly, no, it's only your Weekly Constitutional, but welcome anyway.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's an honor to have you, as always. So, what are we talking about today?
Well, one of the things that I think is that goes unsaid is how regressive the American tax code has become. What I mean by regressive here is that the burdens of the tax code are disproportionately falling in terms of income earned on lower income taxpayers.
Ah, so and poor people are paying more proportionally, percentage-wise, than rich people are.
To clarify, rich people pay the bulk of income taken in by the IRS in terms of the tax take. However, as a proportion of their income, the poor are increasingly paying a greater share of the burden. And one of the consequences of this is that it's feeding socioeconomic immobility for low to middle income workers, and in turn, furthering distrust in government, cynicism, and in my view, explains much of sort of the political disquiet we feel in the nation today.
Before we go on to your thesis and to some of your suggested solutions, I'll say that I was perhaps a young teenager when I heard about the opposite. I heard about the fact that our tax code, at least back in the 1960s, was progressive. And my father, a CPA, explained to me that he paid a higher proportion of his income to the IRS than somebody who made less money. And my immediate thought was, that's not fair. Why should you pay more? And he said, well, I see your point, and it's not like I enjoy it. He said, but you know, on balance, I'm doing pretty well. And I'm doing better than people who make less than I am, so that's okay with me. That was my introduction to progressive taxes, to taxing people at higher brackets at increasing amounts or percentage-wise.
So and remember, I think we mischaracterize the tax code when we by way of example, if someone's in the highest tax bracket, which is someone here north of $500,000, north of that income, you pay the highest marginal income tax rate, which is 37%. Mm-hmm. But the key point to understand is until 500,000, the first 500,000 is not taxed at that rate.
Right.
So your marginal tax rate at the top end of your income is not your average tax rate. However, we unfortunately characterize it as such.
Marginal, of course, means on the last few dollars.
On the last few dollars.
So, right. Under 500, a certain level percentage of taxation, but then you hit that margin, you hit that edge, and then the rate goes up on that money, but not the money below it.
Exactly. Your father was correct in the sense that what he understood was that the government having the resources to address people's problems in terms of having tax resources furthered the socioeconomic mobility that basically helps other citizens have trust in the society they live in. And that was, I think, what your father was trying to convey to you. I think one of the difficulties today is, and one of the inadvertent consequences of the supply-side tax cuts that President Reagan instituted or adumbrated in the 1980s and we've continued further with, is they've led to problems that we didn't anticipate. The first problem I would say is Think of, let's say, someone who is, back in the 1970s, someone earning a seven-figure compensation package. That seven-figure income, anything north of that would have been taxed at what was then a punitive marginal income tax rate of 70%.
Right.
And
if I may back up, in the 50s, it was like 99%, wasn't it?
Exactly. But remember,
we've had very progressive tax rates since World War II.
Exactly. But remember, in the 1950s, there was only a tiny fraction of people earning over $1 million in terms of W-2 earned income. But for those people who had that income earned that way, yes, they faced a, you could argue, punitive tax take. And so we dramatically reduced that, first from 70% to 50% in 1981 under President Reagan. And then in his second term, it was reduced even further to 28%. And we've kept it relatively low ever since then. And one of the strange, unanticipated consequences of these tax cuts has been people in auspicious positions within their employers pushing for bigger and bigger pay packages. Now, that may not seem like a bad thing to push for a bigger and bigger pay package, but the result has been that many American organizations now are paying huge compensation to their best positioned employees in such a way that deprives them of the resources to actually provide pay package increases for their normal workers or even have the resources to hire new workers. And I think that's been an unsaid consequence of these massive tax cuts.
Let me just be clear here. So if I'm a high earner and I've been paying 70% or 99% or whatever it was prior to Reagan, and all of a sudden the tax rate, the marginal tax rate goes down, then instead of asking for other forms of compensation like stock options or perhaps for greater benefits or something of that sort, I would simply say, well, just give me more money because now that money, that higher wage is worth more to me because the marginal tax rate is down. And that is what pushed these people to ask for more wage compensation.
Exactly.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I understood
that. Exactly. Or think, you know, since not to attack the private sector in terms of, but let's be honest, university presidents nationwide are now increasingly earning seven-figure pay packages.
Yes. And professors are not.
Professors are not.
As you and I both know.
Absolutely. And more importantly, clerical staff are dealing with socioeconomic immobility in the vast majority of universities,
right? Clerical staffs are grossly underpaid. I know that from working with many fine people who do not make what they are worth, in my opinion, but that's just me. Please go on.
Yes. And so that's one aspect. The second aspect is, in conjunction with these income tax cuts, we've also made dramatic cuts to the estate tax. And the real consequence to the cuts in the estate tax, once again, has not been necessarily a direct loss of revenue to the government, but it's the same didactic consequence faced by well-positioned employees who think the following: if I stay a few more years, I'll push for a higher pay package, and then I can convey that money to my kids and grandkids in a non-taxable manner that could position them well for life.
Indeed, and let me comment on that. The estate tax, sometimes called the death tax for political reasons, but in some sense that's an accurate statement. That's the tax that is paid upon my death by my beneficiaries, by my heirs.
Yes.
So if I have $1 million and the estate tax is 50%, then half of my money is going to go to the government rather than to my heirs. Which may sound punitive as well, but I think the idea behind the state tax was always that while we certainly like people to go out and work hard and do innovative things and even amass great fortunes, we don't necessarily like the idea of inherited fortunes because that perpetuates power among a small group of people who haven't necessarily done anything to earn it. And simply you're creating sort of a gentry or maybe even an aristocracy. So that was always, I think, the rationale behind having a relatively high estate tax.
Exactly. And the argument is, I would stipulate that all taxes hinder economic activity to some form, to some degree. And ideally, we can minimize the negative consequences of all taxes. However, you could argue that if there's some moment that someone should be taxable and taxing them is not that punitive, it plausibly is when they die. Since the Reagan years, the problem of socioeconomic immobility and a sort of the development of sort of a plutocracy of a wealthy class has gotten to the point where in the United States today, 60% of one's relative income is explained by not work, not education. It is explained by the income of the relative income of one's parents.
This is what my father calls, my dad was a very wise man before he passed away. He called it the Paris Hilton tax. The idea was that we don't necessarily want to create people like Paris Hilton, who, again, do nothing to earn their money and essentially consume them and wield inordinate power, whether social or political or economic, because of inheritance. And you're telling me that there are more and more Paris Hiltons out there.
Perhaps, but more importantly than the Paris Hilton phenomenon is imagine how many people are staying within organizations where they otherwise might retire or what might otherwise agree to a smaller pay package and are absorbing that organization's resources that preclude the organization from either providing better compensation package to the average workers or hiring new workers. So can you? So one of the things we took as an article of faith would be that lowering taxes would improve productivity. There's been no evidence that our cutting of income taxes or the estate taxes improve productivity. In fact, economic productivity in the United States has remained relatively stagnant, and the countries that haven't cut taxes have actually caught up with us in terms of productivity per worker. The real consequence of it has been, however, that there's been an asymmetry in how people are paid, and it's become more difficult for newer workers to get good pay packages when they enter into organizations.
Yeah, you would think that a punitive level tax, 70, 99%, would encourage, or I should say discourage, high earners from working. But I'm just speaking from personal observation here. It seems to me that most people at the top end of the earning scale, they're going to do it anyway. I mean, they are driven by whatever drives them. I mean, to be the high achievers, to be the masters of the universe. And they will continue working and continue producing regardless of the level of tax or the marginal tax that they're paying on their stuff. Now, they may try to avoid them. That's why they hire tax attorneys. There's an entire area of law practice that's designed to avoid paying taxes. I understand that. And they won't necessarily be happy about having a high marginal tax rate. But on the other hand, it's not like they're going to stop working at that higher level.
And you're absolutely right. I would just say this, though, is, and I'm not advocating some sort of class warfare paradigm here. I'm just trying to figure out what would be the best means of engendering socioeconomic mobility. And looking at these problems we face, I see two things. I see a lower income, a marginal income tax reduction in conjunction with an estate tax reduction that has enabled for the development of a sort of plutocratic class in our country, akin to the old Roaring Twenties type situation. So that's perhaps problematic. It's not necessarily so. But one of the problems is the government takes now more than one third of its tax take from what is officially not a tax. That is the payroll tax. In other words, more than 75% of American workers today pay more in Social Security and Medicare taxes than they do in the income tax.
It is your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Akram Pfizer, colleague and friend of mine at the Duncan School of Law. After the break, we'll come back and speak some more with Akram. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a perfectly fascinating discussion with my buddy, Akram Pfizer, all about a new law review article he's written in which he suggests seven different ways to decrease wealth and income inequality and thereby restore trust in our governments. Okay, let's be very clear about this. The income tax is the one we have to fill out the forms for.
Exactly.
And so most people think taxes, they think income taxes, they think IRS, they think I hate filling out those forms and I despise this entire concept. But the payroll tax, okay, or various payroll taxes that are taken out are things you never even see. You'll see them on your statement. If you look at them carefully, you'll see things, something called FICA or something of that sort. But these are things that are taken out and paid out of your pay before you even see your pay.
Exactly.
Okay. And you're telling me that's a higher percentage now.
And officially, as far as Uncle Sam is concerned, that's not a tax. That's a payroll set aside mandated by the government. However, the government treats it the same way as it treats general tax revenue. In other words, it uses the money to fund the government while in conjunction with its payroll obligations it has to satisfy to provide for Social Security and Medicare. Now, Social Security and Medicare do fine things. They're a very, very important part of our safety net. And by international standards, we do have a relatively weak safety net. So what I'm certainly not advocating cutting Social Security or Medicare. What I'm advocating, though, is to fund the entitlement programs via another gamut of taxes and not the highly regressive Social Security and Medicare taxes that right now make it very, very difficult to engender socioeconomic mobility.
Before we get to your solutions, and you have seven of them. In fact, that's the title of your article, Seven Steps to Truly Reform the Tax Code and Engender Socioeconomic Mobility. It was recently published by the Albany Law Review. It's a very good read, and I encourage people to find it. They can find it online, can't they?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, and Akram Fizer is, of course, your name, F-A-I-Z-E-R. So you can Google that and get it. But before we get to your solutions, and they're very interesting, the basic problem here that you seem to be suggesting exists is that we're getting this socioeconomic immobility, and the greater and greater wealth divide between the haves and the haves not has affected our political system as well.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk a little bit more about the problem before we talk about the solution? What do you see as the political implication of this wealth divide?
Well, I think one of the real problems is the wealth divide makes it more and more difficult to cohere the nation and to give us a sense of integrated citizenship where we feel we're in it together. And I think that it has led to a level of cynicism in the electorate that I think becomes problematic in terms of maintaining the rule of law. When I say cynicism, I mean things happen, such as, for example, in a previous generation, someone's accused of obstruction of justice. That would outrage the average citizen. In today's environment, people think, what's it to me? Right. Mm. And I think that I think is bedeviling our politics. So it's leading to a coarsening of our citizenry, and it's undermining our democratic institutions in a way that we would never have anticipated when we brought in these policies.
So the root cause of all this polarization and cynicism and coarseness in our political dialogue is income inequality.
I think that would be I would be going too far to say that,
mm-hmm.
but I certainly think one of the problems that Americans face is the perception that I think it's become disjointed, the idea that if they work hard, they can move up the socioeconomic ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, the reality is, and we struggle saying this, for me to move up the socioeconomic ladder, it requires, as a matter of pure mathematics, someone else to move down the socioeconomic ladder, right? Mm. But it becomes more and more difficult for that to manifest itself if indeed those further up have so many built-in advantages.
Yes.
It's almost impossible for them to face the consequences of their bad decisions.
We've actually seen this. I mean, it's always existed. I mean, the best thing you can do to be wealthy is to choose your parents very, very well.
Yeah.
I think this may be even more true today than it has been, at least in recent American history. We've all seen the phenomenon, this college entrance scandal, which, of course, is horrible to think that somebody could bribe his children's way into college one way or the other, or fake an entrance examination or application. But many commentators have pointed out that this is, in some sense, the tip of the iceberg, that this is really just the going too far in a situation where there are lots of things you can do that technically don't go too far. I've often said that while I'm very proud of my two children and the way that they've excelled academically, they had the advantage of me. And moreover, they had the advantage of my wife, who had devoted herself to assisting them, not in an unethical way, but in many, many ways, you know, sending them to summer enrichment programs, mm-hmm. you know, giving them all sorts of experiences, making sure that they were on track in terms of their college applications, making them aware of opportunities they might not have known existed. I mean, she describes herself occasionally as the tiger mom of mm-hmm. our family.
Mm-hmm.
And parents like that, if they don't go too far, can represent an enormous advantage. And so even as I'm proud of my own children, I lament the fact that I know a lot of other kids who didn't have those advantages
mm-hmm.
and who therefore were not allowed to shine. So it's already a tilted field for people who are the children of, to some extent, wealth and privilege. And so our society is getting even more so, is what
yeah.
you're saying.
Yeah. And so now let's go further, right? Now let's assume now you are... I have no personal animus against him. He seems a very nice young man, but uh-huh. Jared Kushner, right?
Right.
If you're Jared Kushner, right, you got into NYU Law School and Harvard largely because your parents, Charles Kushner, his father, who was an extremely capable businessman, made large donations to each university.
Right.
That's infeasible for the rest of us. But go further, right? I guarantee you the average income that Charles Kushner paid in taxes would have been dramatically less than your typical plumber. In other words...
Percentage-wise. Right.
Percentage-wise. Mm-hmm. Because your typical plumber in America is an independent contractor who pays 15.3% payroll tax plus their federal unemployment compensation plus their state unemployment compensation, and then they pay federal income tax on top of that plus sales tax.
Yes. Right?
And so that person is paying, let's say your typical plumber makes $80,000 a year, a much, much bigger marginal income tax take than, let's say, Charles Kushner does. And the fact that we would have treated whatever income he would have paid himself as passive income that is not even subjected to either the payroll tax or the federal income tax, right? It would have been passive income, and he probably paid a tiny fraction of his income in taxes.
So it's understandable if the child of the plumber doesn't feel like he or she is playing on a level playing field, you know? So what's the point? I'm going to lose anyway. I can't get into those fancy colleges. I'm not part of this community in the same way as the kid living in the nice neighborhood down the street, the children of the lawyers and the doctors are.
Exactly. Now, the problem is, and this is the problem progressives face in this country, is in a debate on the issues, at the end of the day, the plumber's child will vote against the progressive politician who's arguing for tax reform for this very simple reason. Neither the plumber nor his child believes in the federal government or trusts the federal government. In other words, their supposition is the bigger tax take that they might agree to, or let's say, for example, if marginal income taxes were raised on Charles Kushner, all that would achieve would be the money would be diverted to some pet project that that liberals favor and conservatives disfavor. And as a result, neither the plumber nor his child would be in favor of the ostensibly a progressive tax reform. So my, call it a solution if you will, but maybe an adumbration of a solution, is to recognize and sympathize with most Americans' distrust of the federal government, and therefore rather than have unstipended tax takes, to have triggers instituted with each new tax imposition so that the money is directly targeted at funding a program with direct consequences if the tax take is too big or too little on the back end.
So establishing trust by making a deal up front in terms of what the tax is going to be spent on.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, we are now segueing from the problem, which I think we've now identified, to the solution. So I want to hear, what are these seven steps that are going to solve this problem of income inequality, of wealth inequality, or at least address it, and then consequently reestablish perhaps some level of trust and community within our polity?
Yeah, so think of a little thing, right? Think of a small little thing. When I mentioned in my article, I was surprised at how big a payroll tax take I had to pay for my nanny in my child's first 9 months of childcare. My wife and I stayed home with our child the first 9 months. My wife did most of the work. I was able to come here. I'm very thankful, was able to stay home. But after 9 months, for the first 2 years of our daughter's life, she was cared for by a wonderful nanny. But on top of her hourly wage, we had to pay the federal unemployment tax, the state unemployment tax, and the full 15.3% Social Security and Medicare taxes. We had to deduct it and pay it over to the government, right? Make sense? But that was one of the reasons. It wasn't the major reason, but it was a reason that explained why we shifted from a nanny to a preschool, right? Because we would, in other words, we would be saving all those employment taxes. And we also didn't have the burdensome reporting requirements to go with it. And I was thinking to myself, this is plausibly happening to many American workers. How many people are actually precluded from employment because the marginal cost of their employment is slightly shooting up due to the payroll tax?
Right. So if I'm an employer and I'm thinking about hiring a new person, it's not just the wage I'm going to pay that person. It's all of this extra paperwork and all of this extra money that I'm going to have to pay.
Exactly right. And now go further. Increasingly, employers are actually treating their employees as independent contractors, which means that the entire payroll tax burden now is falling on the employee, with the employer having very little skin in the game, right? So the employee's denied things like healthcare benefits and all the rest. And on top of that, they have to pay the entire payroll tax. So in view of the fact that the entitlement programs now cost the government more than 35% of their tax take, they're extremely expensive to fund, and I recognize their importance, my recommendation is to completely eliminate these payroll taxes. In other words, an immediate $1.1 trillion tax cut for the American worker.
Okay.
The problem is, how do we fund the entitlement programs? And, you know, so all of a sudden, I've lost the entire Democratic Party when I say cut the payroll tax.
Okay. Again, that funds Social Security and Medicare and all those things that are so important to us.
And so popular with many Americans,
yes,
right? Especially voting seniors. But my argument would be that a far better means of funding these programs are what I outline here in these papers. First, I would recommend we reintroduce the estate tax. That would have the fortuitous benefit, not so much of generating revenue, though it does generate non-negligible revenue, but it would enable and disincentivize workers to negotiate punitive pay packages from their employers in a way that precludes socioeconomic mobility. So that'll be some revenue that accomplishes. It'll be about $100 billion in revenue, which would be a reinstitution of the estate tax to at 40% above $5 million estates.
Okay, so you're basically saying that anybody who dies with $5 million or more, his or her beneficiaries would then pay a 40% tax on that amount over the $5 million.
Except there would still remain the spousal exemption.
Okay.
So there would be no tax going to the spouse. But once it goes to the next generation, anything north of $5 million will be subject to the 40% estate tax.
So your first $5 million, no estate tax.
Exactly.
Because this is a very tiny percentage of people.
It's only about 2% of people.
Right.
But it does have the fortuitous benefit of disincentivizing people from staying in jobs just to bequeath to their children and grandchildren estates. Mm-hmm. Right. Sizable estates in a way that's unheard of to 98% of Americans.
Right. Well, that's an important point to make, is that when you talk about the death tax, you're talking about the 2%.
And right now, it's the 0.1%.
Right now, only the 0.1% are paying. So there's a mythology out there that the so-called death tax is going to destroy family farms or destroy small businesses, but that is a myth.
Because
people who own farms and small businesses are not bequeathing this much money to their children.
That is about as legitimate a claim as the tooth fairy. The most important policy, though, I would recommend is institution of an 8% sales tax, a national sales tax. Mm-hmm. That would generate about $650 billion a year. In other words, nearly two-thirds of the lost revenue by way of a national sales tax that would fund the entitlement programs.
Hold on just a second. National sales tax. So basically, you're going to eliminate all these payroll taxes. So, hey, my paycheck's bigger. That's great. And if I'm an employer, then I've got less disincentive to hire people. That's great. So maybe I'll hire more people. On the other hand, as soon as I turn around and I'm going to spend my money, wait a second, everything's 8% more expensive.
That's
a sales tax. Okay, so you're going to get me one way or the other. Why is that better? Why is it better to have this sales tax?
It's better for this reason, is that it's not a disincentive to employment and wage growth. And recognizing it's regressive, you can do various things to minimize the regressivity.
Okay, so once again, that word regressive. That means if I put an 8% across the board tax on everything that everybody buys, it's going to hit poor people more because they spend a greater proportion of their money, or they're going to spend most of their paycheck on a given month.
Yes.
Whereas a rich person doesn't have to. A rich person has so much money that he or she does not have to spend everything every month.
Yeah. So take the Hornbook example. If I give you $1 million salary, you'll save at least $300,000, which means...
I have pretty expensive tastes.
Yeah. In other words, to a maximum, you'll pay 8% on $700,000 of your income.
Right.
Right? Whereas if you pay me $100, a beggar's wage, I'll definitely spend all of it.
Probably the first day, yeah.
Yeah, and which means I'll spend definitively all of my income. I will be taxed on the entirety of my income.
Okay.
So because of that, sales taxes are seen as regressive. However, in view of the fact that they are not a disincentive to employment and wage growth, sales taxes end up having some positive public policy consequences. First, they generate revenue, but they generate revenue in a way that doesn't hurt productivity and employment. Two is, to some degree, they send a didactic message of the value of saving, mm-hmm. and that's a useful thing. And so, for example, you notice in the United States, one of the big stressors we face as a country is all Americans, we have a tendency not to save an adequate percentage of our paycheck, myself included in that, if I can be quite honest with you, Stuart. And you'll notice that for the same level...
You are a very spiffy dresser.
Well, you know, that's source of my problems, right? But if you compare us to other high-income countries, we save a sizably smaller proportion of our paycheck. Mm-hmm. And if you take that smaller savings rate in conjunction with our more threadbare safety net, it explains why so many American workers face so much more stress in their day-to-day lives, right? They have far lower savings rates, much less money put away, and they have should they lose their job, a much more threadbare safety net to see them through their next job.
Right? Okay, so you're telling me that I'm going to get a bigger pay package, and I'm going to turn around, and consumer goods are going to be 8% more expensive. And so the effect on me is going to make me hesitate a little bit more before I spend money on things and maybe decide that I'm going to save more money rather than spend more money. But doesn't that also, by a depressing demand for consumer products, is that going to have a negative effect on our economy? I mean, some people call that the paradox of thrift, that if from an individual perspective, it's good for me. Mm. But from a macro perspective, everybody spends less. That's 70% of our GDP. Mm-hmm. And isn't that going to hurt the economy generally?
You're right. I mean, if you look at the statistics, we spend about 77% of our GDP is explained by consumer spending. However, it's a little problematic that it's that high. So, for example, you look at Germany, about 50% of German economic activity is explained by consumer spending. And the difference is largely, I think, the consequence of that difference is you know, more jobs in things like high-end manufacturing, fewer jobs in things like low-end retail. Mm-hmm. And I think, to some degree, the paradox of thrift outlines a short-term problem, but I think the consequence of excessive consumer demand or excessive reliance on consumer spending to stimulate the economy is, in the long haul, lower productivity growth.
Yep. The only thing that's going to increase productivity is going to be investment.
Yeah.
And so if we shift a significant portion of our GDP from consumption to investment, for example, or savings, then interest rates will be lower, and productivity ultimately will be higher. And individual consumers, broadly speaking, will be better off.
Mm-hmm.
So I see where you're going with this, but there could be at least a short-term hit to the GDP growth.
That's right.
Maybe that would be, do you advocate phasing this sort of thing in? I mean, maybe we could ameliorate that by not doing it instantaneously.
Well, one thing I advocate is, as I said earlier, a use of triggers. I recognize none of us would prefer to pay more rather than less taxes. I mean, by way of example, think of something even silly like this. I like to shop at the duty-free store when I'm at an international airport.
Sure.
Right? Save whatever it is that it's duty. All of us like to do that. However, I think most Americans would buy into a paradigm that specifically set forth the following. We're bringing in a sales tax, and you're not going to enjoy paying it. If we could convey to the public that the tax take is not just there for a grab bag of liberal pet programs, but instead will be there to do no more than to maintain the existing entitlement programs, and with consequences such as if the tax take is too small, the taxes will be ratcheted up for the subsequent year. But if it's too big, it'll be ratcheted down or lowered accordingly. I think the public would see there'd be buy-in from the public, because we won't have to deal with the problem of institutional distrust in the federal government.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week, my guest is Akram Pfizer. And as you just heard, he's concerned about distrust in the federal government, and he's proposed several ways to restore it. After the break, we'll finish our conversation with Akram. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with my friend and colleague, Akram Pfizer, who teaches with me at the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University. Akram's written an article in which he suggests several ways in which to reduce distrust in government and thereby maybe somehow reduce the political polarization and extremism that we're seeing in the country these days. Among his proposals is one we just discussed, where he's going to replace the federal payroll tax with a sales tax, which would be specifically dedicated to funding Social Security and Medicare, and would go up if the revenue was insufficient and go down if it was too much. Akram identifies several advantages to such a national sales tax.
It gives you some household discretion in how you decide to use your resources, right? In other words, to some degree, if you decide to spend your entirety of your income, you'll be taxed. But if you decide not to, the tax take against you will be lower.
Right.
So it does encourage savings.
It does. You get to choose when you buy something whether or not you're going to pay that tax. Okay. What other ideas do you have in your seven solutions, your seven steps?
What prompted this, I was reading an excellent biography of former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, and it pointed out that basically when former President Clinton left office, he was leaving office. Al Gore had just lost the 2000 presidential election to then Governor George W. Bush. And Paul O'Neill was named as the incoming Treasury Secretary. O'Neill at the time was the head of Alcoa Corporation, and he had a close relationship then with Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, and they recommended him to then President-elect Bush to come in as the incoming Treasury Secretary. They anticipated the federal government would generate $5.6 trillion in surpluses over the coming 10 years based on their projections. And they advocated returning the money to the American public by means of income tax cuts. And O'Neill said he would support that provided there were triggers instituted in the income tax cut, such that if we reverted to deficits, the marginal rates would come back to their pre-tax cut rates, in other words, to the top 39.6% rate that it was under President Clinton. Well, for whatever reason, Dick Cheney did not recommend those triggers be instituted, and we brought in marginal income tax cuts that then, based on lower than anticipated economic growth and the cost of our response to 9/11, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the unfunded additional government liabilities that we brought in, such as the prescription benefit to Medicare that former President Bush brought in, those $5.6 trillion in surpluses never materialized. What we saw was something like $6 trillion in deficits added on over the ensuing 8 years. And so, recognizing what O'Neill proposed, I decided to piggyback on his then proposal that was never adopted, which is to bring in triggers to ensure that whatever cuts I'm advocating don't jeopardize our fiscal viability.
Yeah, actually, that's another salutary effect of your proposals, is that if you've got these triggers, as you call them, you can calibrate your tax revenues to the expenditures that you anticipate. So, for example, if we go back a step and we talk about entitlement programs, not only would you reduce taxes in the event of a surplus collection of taxes, you'd increase taxes in the event that you weren't covering Social Security properly. Mm-hmm. And we would avoid, perhaps, the situation we're in now, where we're looking down the barrel of a gun and we're seeing that Social Security Trust Fund is going to run out in a certain number of years, which, of course, will profoundly affect people of your generation and mine, because we're going to be the ones who are going to be wanting to be retired at that point. Mm-hmm. And the people behind us, I mean, there's a growing sense of despair in the generations that follow us, because the economic situation, the entitlement programs look like they're going to be broke by the time that those generations arrive, in addition to all the other problems that they're going to inherit. So maybe your proposal would have some effect on this as well.
I hope so. I mean, what prompted me to write this piece is I have a United States and Canadian nationality, both very successful countries. But Canada, like some countries in Western Europe, and unlike the United States, has certain things. Its government has a broader portfolio of taxes to generate revenue and fund government obligations. For example, Canada has a much stiffer exaction for a gas tax. The United States, we have a very minimal gas tax, and in terms, and basically the gas tax of, I think, roughly 12.4 cents a gallon has remained the same since it was in 1994, which means in real terms, it's a fraction of what it once was.
Isn't that one of the most remarkable things? People are extremely sensitive to gas pump prices. And again, talking about my father, the CPA, he would drive miles to save a couple of pennies on gas, even though he would acknowledge to me later that he probably burned more gas
To drive there.
He said, I just can't stand looking at those numbers turning around and around, and if they're higher than they have to be. And that's a very common perception. It's an emotional response. And that's why people are so sensitive to that, and to gas taxes for that reason, because, of course, that makes the numbers leap. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably explains why we're paying, in some sense, less than we were in real terms, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
But the problem is, you know, unlike Western European countries that maybe charge $5, $6, $7 a gallon.
Yes.
We basically have a negligible tax, which in turn means we're over-reliant on automobiles, and our government does not have adequate resources, right? So what one of the consequences of having such a low gas tax is we overconsume petroleum, which in turn puts pressure on world prices, makes us over-reliant on foreign sources of petroleum, and makes it much more difficult for us to, for example, fund needed government programs to advance the needs of American citizens. So one thing that, let's say, a gas tax of $1 a gallon would do is generate $100 billion to the federal government. If we had, for example, Western European levels of gas tax, which I'm not advocating, but something closer to that, we would have, for example, the level of financial resources that would make things potentially like affordable childcare or affordable public university education much more feasible. The thing we us Americans don't want to acknowledge is every good thing comes at the expense of another good thing. And you could argue, and I wouldn't argue this, that cheap gas is a good thing. I think it's a little simplistic to call it a good thing. But our lack of a gas tax precludes our government from being able to do good things that many of us would like our government to be able to do for us.
Well, we have touched upon many of your seven solutions already. Before we leave entirely the subject of a national sales tax, you mentioned that it is regressive, generally speaking. but I neglected to ask you why your proposal would not be so regressive.
Because what we would do with, like many developed countries do, including Canada, is you mail a rebate check or a check to lower-income households to compensate for some of the regressivity. So Canada has a federal goods and services tax of 5% on all purchases. And in Canada, what they do is they mail out a check every 3 months for about $100 to a per family, to low-income families, to make up for some of that regressivity. But the advantage for Canada has been, by having this goods and services tax, Canada has been less reliant on a payroll tax, and it has seen much higher rates of socioeconomic mobility since the 1990s. Canada broadened its goods and services tax in 1990. Since 1990, in terms of overall household income, in terms of aggregate GDP, both countries have performed roughly equally. But in terms of how equally distributed that growth has been, it's been much more effective in Canada. In other words, median and low-income households have done much better in Canada than in the United States.
So if I'm a relatively poor Canadian family, I don't like the fact that I'm paying an 8% tax on everything I buy, but every quarter I get a check from the government that will, to some extent, make up for that and make that particular tax less regressive, less a burden on poor people like me.
Mm. And so you're exactly right. So a working class, middle class Canadian household pays slightly higher income taxes, dramatically higher sales taxes, dramatically higher gas taxes. However, they have access to much more affordable higher education, affordable effective health care, and at the working class and middle class level, wage mobility and socioeconomic mobility for their kids in a way that is unheard of to the American worker.
Yes, we often hear about the Canadian healthcare system. I will mention that my brother, the FBI agent, spent several years as liaison to the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and he lived in Vancouver and had some medical issues in his family up there at that time, and cannot say enough about the Canadian healthcare system. How simple it was, just yeah. Walking in and getting your services, not worrying about healthcare costs, not worrying about them bankrupting you if some terrible event happened within your family. And that's one of the things that Canada is able to fund through this tax structure you have. Well, we have actually touched upon many of the 7 recommendations that you have, but I think one thing here that's a bit wonkish, but some people will appreciate it, was that after suggesting eliminating federal payroll tax and recouping the money by broadening the estate tax, your recommendation number 3 is to adjust the existing tax laws so that recipients of bequests, no longer receive automatically stepped up basis to avoid tax liability. Okay, explain to me what is a basis.
Okay, so basis refers to, it's kind of inside baseball term. Assume I buy an asset, right? And I buy it, and then I sell it. I buy it for $100,000. And then it appreciates to $300,000. Let's say it's a home. That appreciation, that in other words, the delta between what I paid and what I sell for, is considered my gains from a basis of $100,000.
So this is where we get the term capital gains.
Yes. And I paid, therefore, I have to pay typically a tax based on the $200,000 gain based on that appreciation.
Okay.
However, as a strange, based on trying to harmonize the reduction based on of the estate tax, what they did was they said, if you bequeath that asset, you automatically get stepped up basis from at the new sale price. So for example, my wife and I buy a home for $100,000. We sell it for $300,000. That's a gain on $200,000.
Right. And if that happens today, then you're going to have to pay tax on that gain.
That's right.
Okay, that's a form of income, capital gains.
That's right.
Okay.
However,
but
if we bequeath that same home to our daughter, she
and then you die, and then she takes it as a beneficiary, okay?
Yes.
And she takes it and
sells it.
Right.
She has stepped up basis. In other words, she sells from the new sale price will be the new baseline for basis.
So in other words, that $200,000 of capital gains, it's just a gimme.
That's exactly right.
It goes away. There is no tax on the gain because it happened to be a bequest rather than a sale while you're alive.
That's right. And the real
who does that benefit? It benefits the next generation.
That's right.
And often of very wealthy people who have the most to gain from this sort of situation.
That's right. And when I think of, this may sound a simplistic thing, but when I think of when I wrote this piece, I was sitting one weekend and I saw the great Al Pacino movie, Scent of a Woman Again. There was the character, the main protagonist, who's a scholarship student at a school that's supposed to be sort of like a Phillips Exeter Academy or an Andover. And he's there on scholarship as a low-income student. And all his classmates are wealthy trust fund kids whose families are well off. And what I'm trying to get at here is, in writing this piece, is wouldn't it be nice if indeed most Americans didn't face a situation where life success went only to those with the trust funds?
I went to a fancy college and met a lot of those people. I was there. I love my alma mater, but I'll tell you what, that phenomenon is real, absolutely real. We're getting short on time. One other thing that you suggest that will make people's ears prick up is your recommendation number 5, end the mortgage interest tax deduction. Now, my CPA has been telling me for years, I need to own a house. I need that that mortgage interest deduction. But you're telling me that maybe I shouldn't have it?
The real problem with the mortgage interest deduction, it's basically favored by the real estate industry for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But what it basically does, it's a huge tax deduction for high income earners or people who buy extremely high value real estate that enables them to sort of do better by deducting the mortgage interest than taking the standard deduction on their mortgage.
So I buy a house and let's say I finance 100% just for simplicity's sake, and it's a $1 million house. And I've got a 5% mortgage. That's $50,000 a year I'm paying in interest to buy this house. And I get to deduct all of that
from
my incomes. And so I'm reducing my tax burden.
That's right.
And that's something, again, that's available only to people with the means to buy a house. So by definition, people who are renters don't get it. And by and large, people who rent are not as well off financially as people who buy. So it's another advantage for the rich and disadvantage for the poor.
And in a weird way, it sets up an unfortunate message to people to overconsume housing as opposed to spend their money in a more responsible way. And that overconsumption in housing explains things like the financial crisis when we had it, right?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, people were overconsuming housing, taking the following position: don't leave any money on the table. So notice there's no rational reason why the mortgage interest deduction should be there. No other developed country has a mortgage interest deduction. The United Kingdom did away with it in the years of Margaret Thatcher. It shouldn't be the case anymore. To the Trump administration...
Margaret Thatcher did away with it? I thought she was an arch-conservative.
She's an arch-conservative, but she is a real woman, a pragmatic woman who understood that the British public wanted public services. And there were various taxes that had to be interposed to fund those public services. And so she made the rational assumption, I think consistent with free market economics and basic conservative principles, that ending the mortgage interest deduction enabled her to further lower marginal income tax rates and other payroll tax rates.
All right, let me play devil's advocate. To someone listening to this for the first time, this sounds like it almost could be part of Elizabeth Warren's platform.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all that this is? Is this simply a grab bag of progressive tax proposals that progressive and liberal Democrats would like? Or is there, again, is there some deeper purpose behind all of this?
What distinguishes my proposal, I think, from a typical Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren proposal is, I'm not saying tax the rich. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying reapportion taxes. And tax people of all socioeconomic classes, including the poor, I'm not exempting anybody, but just reallocate how these taxes are exacted such that we can do away with foolhardy taxes like the payroll tax and implement, I think, more effective taxes that don't have the same negative public policy consequences. My supposition is if we were to ask Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders whether this is a good idea, they would see this as utopian and merely a precatory step to eliminate the entitlement programs, and they'd say this would be a no-go.
So this actually is a conservative proposal from their perspective, because you'd just, it'd be a subterfuge in order to get rid of Medicare and Social Security.
My guess is that's how they'd see it.
Right.
But what my argument is, and what I think my disquiet with people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, notwithstanding the fact I admire them both greatly, is I think they are refusing in their policies to recognize the distrust of the federal government, which has enabled, for example, supply-side tax cutters to further go further and further with tax cuts in a way that, notwithstanding the lack of empirical evidence, it's gone unrebutted by Democratic administrations when they do take office. So we've seen a constant ratchet effect of cutting marginal taxes, and when Democratic administrations come into power, for example, the Clinton and Obama administrations, they really have not been able to really reverse the massive tax cuts effectively. And the consequence has been this socioeconomic immobility that most of us face.
Not to mention, although there are other issues involved here, the ballooning of the national deficit and the national debt, which we've seen really since the 1990s. I remember that brief, marvelous moment in the 1990s when I think it was late in the second Clinton administration that we actually moved out of deficit and people started actually paying down the national debt. Mm-hmm. And we actually had some debates as to whether that would be a good thing because Treasury bills, which is, of course, the instrument through which we fund the national debt, are an important investment vehicle. And people were actually saying, maybe we shouldn't pay this down. I mean, that was a wonderful debate to have.
Mm-hmm. It was a
wonderful debate. And, of course, it's just disappeared, as you say, ever since the first Bush administration.
And notice, though, the Bush administration won that argument in the political culture, largely with the support of conservative Democrats in the U.S. Senate, for example. I remember the key to that package was John Brough of Louisiana, because what Bush understood, and so did Brough, was the American public did not trust the federal government to manage money, and that was the problem.
And Americans have never liked taxes. In fact, I seem to recall that was one of our rallying cries during the American Revolution, and I always cite a little rhyme that I hear whenever taxes come up: don't tax you, don't tax me, let's tax that feller behind the tree.
That's true. But I would say this, if I can, just before we leave, is right now we're in a political impasse whereby Americans increasingly want Hong Kong levels of taxation and European levels of social services. And that's just not feasible. And so we have to find a way of having tax exactions that are the least harmful, because the current paradigm whereby we insist politicians offer us Asian tiger levels of taxation and social democratic levels of social services is not feasible.
Akram Pfizer of the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University, thank you so much for sharing this with us. And once again, I'll let you read the title. What's the title of your article in the Albany Law Review?
Okay. 7 Steps to Truly Reform the Tax Code and Engender Socioeconomic Mobility.
Thanks, Akram.
Thank you. Thanks, Stuart, very much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my buddy, Akram Pfizer at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. What an interesting set of proposals. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.